We won't be able to make a dent in reducing human trafficking crimes until people acknowledge that the crimes are occurring in front of us. And we must refuse to tolerate commercial sex. People also need to know how to recognize the victims of human trafficking.
That was Indiana Attorney General Greg Zeller this week in response to a new statewide billboard campaign that features messages about human trafficking. On Wednesday, state leaders, law enforcement, trafficking support groups, and outdoor representatives unveiled the 35 billboards, which feature acts about human trafficking and encourage victims to seek help and others to report it. The ads will be up until April 6th. Organizers say they're hoping to spread the word not just to Hoosiers, but also to people traveling to Indiana for the NCAA Final Four. More than 210 cases of human trafficking have been reported in the state since 2007, and nationally, an estimated 1.5 million of them are in the United States, many of them minors recruited for prostitution. Today on The Trend, we're talking to a panel of experts to hear what it looks like in Evansville and the tri-state region. Joining me now, I have Sergeant Gregory Montz from the Evansville Police Department. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And I have Whitney Weir from Albion Fellows Bacon Center. She's a child advocate. Good afternoon, Whitney.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and if you have questions for our guests, by the way, please give us a call, 812-426-7400, or you can send us a tweet at The Trend Talks. Now, last month, Evansville Police Department's Vice Unit conducted a prostitution sting that led to 6 arrests. The police had received complaints about a website, backpage.com, which advertises sex for money, and the EPD detectives placed an advertisement on the site, got a few clicks, and a female officer posed as a prostitute to meet and ultimately arrest the suspects. Police arrested 56-year-old Gary Skye of Evansville, 49-year-old Scott Stephen Altman of Evansville, 27-year-old James Oscar Leffler of Henderson, 27-year-old Justin Ray Durbin of Henderson, 45-year-old Robert Lee Taylor of Hanson, Kentucky, and 31-year-old Amy Christine Williams of Hanson, Kentucky. This was all on charges of patronizing a prostitute, which is a Class A misdemeanor, which is punishable by up to a year in jail and a fine of $5,000. Now, Sergeant Motz, I mentioned those names to give listeners a sense of the variance among ages and geographic locations. Can you tell us more about the suspects in this case?
Well, I think if you look at the nature of the problem, prostitution in general and of human trafficking that goes along hand in hand with prostitution, it's not going to be, you can look at any, you know, socioeconomic background, any, it's not a white-black problem. This is a societal issue that, you know, transverses income, education. You know, this is, you know, a basic human need that has been around since time started. So, you know, the ability of a law enforcement agency to eliminate that is unrealistic. What we are focusing on, we did a detail last month. We had some complaints, and we ran the detail more as a proof of concept to determine, you know, how reliable the information we'd received was to figure out, you know, how does Backpage work and, you know, the risks involved, because at the end of the day, you know, this is something you see on the internet, and the dangers to both the person patronizing the prostitute and the danger to the prostitute are significant, as you've read countless stories about, you know, what happens to people that met on Craigslist years ago and, you know, never came back. So there is a significant personal threat as well as, you know, some community health interests that we're always trying to mitigate as far as, and it's just a misdemeanor. So, you know, the effort, you know, we have several things in the unit that we do. So it's hard to find that balance between, you know, what is a consensual agreement between two people and, you know, how much effort we have to put towards that.
We're talking about human trafficking and prostitution on The Trend today, and right now I've got Sergeant Motz. You're welcome to give us a call with your questions, 812-426-7400, or send us a tweet. So human trafficking, What are the numbers here in Evansville? How big of an issue is it, or is it an issue at all?
Well, it's hard to tell, because when you're talking about human trafficking, aside from narcotics trafficking, human trafficking is right up there with arms smuggling as one of the major economic, stimuluses for organized crime around the world. So you're talking about billions of dollars. Some estimated as much as $32 billion last year. Across the world.
Oh.
In human trafficking, that is both in forced labor and in sex. So the money out there is fantastic. And when you have that kind of money, you will always find somebody that's willing to take the risk of getting caught at it.
Well, a lot of resources that I looked at kept saying it's actually a growing industry, or it's the second largest and fastest growing criminal industry. That's according to the Indiana Protection of Abused and Trafficked Humans report. What is that based on? What is causing it to grow faster?
Well, I think you've got several factors. Number one, there is a demand. It's the same with narcotics. If there's nobody to buy your product, then nobody's going to sell it because there's no financial incentive for that. The other part of that is to look at the victims. Your typical victim is either going to be very young, if you're talking about a citizen of the United States, or you could be looking at an undocumented or illegal immigrant, that has been brought either for the promise of coming to America or lured by a false promise of a job or an occupation. And then they get here and the game changes, and now they're trapped in a society where their cultural background, because of where they were raised, may not be trustful of law enforcement. They're alone, they're outside of their community. So that puts that victim on an island where it's very difficult. They may not even speak English. So their ability to communicate that they have a problem and their mistrust of the police, those are two significant things that really work against us when we're trying to identify a human trafficking, organization that's operating.
Yeah, we should be clear that, there are kind of two separate cases of trafficking. There's the sex trade, and then there's also people who are trafficked into the country for labor. So it sounds like what you're talking about are, foreign victims of trafficking. Is that right?
Sure. And, female victims, we've been receiving complaints of, especially on Backpage ads, that you are seeing people coercing children as young as 13 to 14 years old who are members of our community into committing sex acts for money. And initially, again, you have those promises of easy cash and it turns into something else. And then, now I coerce the victim as a pimp, I coerce the victim by saying, I'm going to tell everybody what you do and what you are to get them to continue that behavior.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to prostitution and in the case of this sting, I understand we can't give away the details of where this occurred for protection of the business, but is that a common scenario where it's kind of a transaction or interaction that takes place online and then they meet at a hotel? Or
based on what we understand from what we've been told, it can work that way. So the business is irrelevant because it happens probably in almost every hotel that, that's just a location for them to meet, if that's the case. There are also girls that go to people's homes, which again, is a significant peril for the person that's engaging in, selling the services. Because you don't know what you're going to get. It's, based off an internet ad, and there's no personal connection. You don't know anything about the place where you're going.
Sure. And so how are officers instructed or told to interact with someone that they suspect is a victim of trafficking or forced prostitution?
Well, it's very difficult on scene because, again, they may not be trusting of us. Most policemen are males. So if you have a female victim, then it's sometimes it's difficult to get a female officer to help. And sometimes that's when we use our partners like Albion and some of the other places to give us, in Holly's House, to give us the opportunity to connect with the victim in a way that is non-threatening and they can understand that we're here to help.
Mm-hmm. Well, because as it stands right now under Indiana law, it is illegal to sell sex. So how, is there I don't know, some instruction or communication in place where they work with police who, you know, if someone is a victim, you know, how do you walk that line between criminal and victim?
Well, if the crime is committed by an unwilling participant, then that person, if they're coerced by force or the threat of force, then that person would be a victim. So, you know, that they're, then that's why the act of pimping is taken more seriously than the act of prostitution because of the probability of coercion or, you know, so, excuse me.
Okay. It's just interesting because statewide, different states have laws on this. And in Illinois, for example, it's only illegal to purchase sex. In Indiana, it's a different case. And I wonder if that causes fewer women to feel comfortable or safe reporting the situation they're in.
That could be true. There's punishments for being a prostitute, but you know, we don't see streetwalkers anymore with the advent of the traditional, you know, pretty woman style girl walking up and down the street is very, very rare anymore because of the advent of technology, the internet, you know, these back pages, your mobile phone has access, gives you connection to anywhere in the world at any time. So people are making those connections on the internet as opposed to driving up and down Fairs Avenue to look for someone interested in selling their services.
So now it's a digital marketplace.
Very much so. And that increases the difficulty of locating it because if you're not, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of manpower to search all those places where the connections are being made. So Backpage is just one of the many sites that are out there that, you know, identifying the problem is more difficult than dealing with the problem in most cases. But if you don't provide the fear of exposure to the people purchasing, then you know you're not going to affect the problem because you're not limiting demand. Mm-hmm. Taking a woman that's willing to sell herself for money because she has a drug addiction or something like that going on, which is very common, there's always going to be somebody else. If you put fear that someone that, hey, if I go and try and purchase sex, I may be purchasing from a police officer and my whole family, my wife, my church, my community is going to see my name in the paper. That is a significant social blockade to people going out and doing that.
Well, that leads up to my question about the people who are arrested and the sting. Did they have previous criminal histories, or you know, who really, really help us understand who the Johns are, people who are buying sex?
Based on what we saw on that, you're looking at people from all over the spectrum. I mean, you're not looking at uneducated people. You're looking at, you know, we had a couple that were very educated folks. We had, you know, some working class people. We had, you know, some young and some old. It was pretty much across the spectrum. So really, I don't think you can, you know, you can limit it to say this is what a person looks like that purchases sex because it's so pronounced throughout society.
Well, I have a page from the Backpage.com website up on my computer right now. And hopefully nobody gets a hold of my Google history. But does the police ever work on the back end? You know, seeing a posting from, I'm seeing one from a hot, sexy babe right now. You know, do they ever try to reach out or try to figure out who's posting that or what, you know,
well,
how does that
you
work?
You know, some of the common themes that we run across are, and again, our focus is on, you know, more victim type things such as underage victims and, you know, human trafficking. So what we're going to be looking for, we typically look at strip clubs, you know, have a reputation for that. And there are some instances where strip clubs are avenues for, you know, prostitution. There's also massage parlors, which also can be heavily involved or are more proportionally likely to be involved in human trafficking, because, you know, your Asian massage places, you know, that there's, you know, several indicators that, you know, the people there, new immigrants, don't speak good English, you know, so there's opportunity there. Not all of them are bad. But that is those are places that we look into, because those are where we typically get our complaints. And typically, because it's a misdemeanor crime, it's complaint driven, because of the sheer magnitude, with the number of detectives that we have to devote to this problem part time, because we've got other things that we have going as well with the unit. It's challenging to find a balance between, you know, how we engage the problem.
Well, as you heard in the beginning of the program, several of the organizers of the campaign for the billboards across the state, they said one of the reasons they were putting these kind of raising awareness campaign billboards around is because of the upcoming NCAA tournament in Indianapolis, which also reminded me, I think a similar thing happened before the Super Bowl. I know in Brazil, before World Cup, there was a campaign to combat trafficking and prostitution. What is there some sort of linkage there between sporting events?
Well, no, because, you know, if you get into a national or world level event, you're talking about people that aren't afraid to spend thousands of dollars on tickets. So there's money there. There's opportunity to make big money. And, you know, the sex trade is going to follow that, because, you know, that it's about money at the end of the day. And, you know, if you want to break it down into the moral component, look at, you know, how many of the people involved in the sex trade have abuse backgrounds, have, you know, addiction problems that contribute, or, you know, they're feeding a methamphetamine, heroin, opana problem, and that's what they do to get their fix. So, you know, you're not really looking at a person who makes a logical, rational decision that, hey, I'm going to sell myself for money.
Well, we're going to talk to a representative from the Albion Fellows Bacon Center in a moment. You're listening to The Trend on WNIN. That is Sergeant Gregory Motz from Evansville Police. If you have questions for either of our guests, you can give us a call, 812-426-7400, or send us a tweet at The Trend Talks. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll talk some more.
You're listening to The Trend on WNIN-FM.
Listening to The Trend on WNIN. Today we're talking about human trafficking and prostitution, which is an international, national, statewide, and even regional issue. Joining me now, I've got Whitney Weir. She's a child advocate at the Albion Fellows Bacon Center. Good afternoon, Whitney.
Good afternoon.
Well, first, I thought it was interesting. There is actually no specific organization in town that is addressing this issue. Could you explain a little bit what's going on? I know you're very passionate about this.
Yeah, that's correct. So in the Evansville area, we do not have any dedicated services for working with victims of human trafficking. In the Indianapolis area, they do have dedicated services, and we do have a statewide coalition, which you did mention earlier, the Indiana Protection for Abused and Trafficked Humans Task Force. And so at Albion, our mission is to prevent domestic and sexual violence and to empower victims through advocacy, education, support services, and collaborative partnerships. And so we, myself, especially on a personal level, have taken a special interest in human trafficking, because we believe that as our community begins to see victims of this crime, places like Albion or like Sergeant mentioned, Holly's House, we are those agencies that people are going to be looking to help serve these victims. And so we're trying to educate ourselves and the community on the problem so that as that begins to happen, we are prepared to offer them the same services that we currently offer to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault.
You said as you begin to see more, have you been seeing more recently?
Yes, I have heard about more cases, and I just think especially like with the prostitution sting that you all were talking about, as law enforcement is getting more complaints and are able to take more steps to fight this problem, then I think we will see victims, because as you can see, the problems, the cases that you see in places like Indianapolis and Louisville and cities like that, I think that we will see the same type of victimization here, like forced prostitution, domestic minor sex trafficking. I think it's likely that those things are going on here as well. And I think as our community takes notice of that, like we have a lot lately with what the police department has been doing, then we will begin to see more.
What is that belief based off of? Are you seeing more clients, or, you know, quantify for that us if you can?
I don't know how to quantify, but even victims that I work with on domestic violence, as I listen to their stories from growing up, I can definitely see strands of human trafficking that have been going on throughout their lifetime. And so I think that since we are not necessarily as a community educated on human trafficking, we don't always see those small things, because some people get this idea that human trafficking is like these big prostitution rings, like it's organized crime, but it's not always going to be that way. And so sometimes, since it's on a smaller scale, people just don't think that it's happening here. And so but it's very much linked with drugs and prostitution and problems that we do see as a problem in our community. And so the problems that we do see and fight in our community, I think are very much linked to this crime as well. And that's kind of what leads me to believe that it's definitely going on in our community.
Can you really illustrate that for us? You said like strands of prostitution in someone's situation. What would that look like?
I mean, like on a really extreme level, I've had victims of, you know, domestic violence or stories that I've heard from victims in the Indianapolis area that even as children that they were, you know, sold by parents or by other people in their life for drugs and for rent and for money and different things like that.
Sold by their parents as children.
As a prostitute.
Wow. Yeah. And how did you work with them?
I mean, really the approach is very similar to the way that we work with our domestic violence and sexual assault victims. A lot of the victims that we see have gone through a pattern of abuse throughout their life. So we're addressing those types of problems like post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, different things that they're experiencing because of that type of victimization that they had in their life. And so we're really addressing those things the same way that we address it with other victims. One of the really big differences is just that a lot of the times with trafficking victims, you'll do like vocational and educational training because they haven't had those things throughout their life because of the type of world that they were caught up in, which is also true sometimes for victims of other crimes.
So I imagine there's a lot of certainly emotional and psychological harm that's being done to someone who's been trafficked and forced into this. But what other sorts of needs are there that aren't being met, or are there still cultural stigmas associated with it?
I think that, kind of the main things that they need are, you know, shelter and food, those basic needs, because especially for young women who are trapped in sex trafficking, one of the ways they continue to be trapped is because they don't feel that they have any other means. And so they need those, just those basic needs. Basic needs mm-hmm. are going to be the very first thing. But then also, yes, there is a stigma about having been in prostitution or working in strip club. Working in the sex industry in any way is going to have a stigma about it. And so that is something that they definitely have to overcome and feel empowered that they are capable and that they're worth more.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you're referring to, like, in terms of finding a job.
Yes.
And how that translates in the future for their lives.
Right. And just for how they feel about themselves, because, I mean, sex crimes are a very degrading thing. And so they, when someone's coming out of having not only another person had total control over their life, but also that they were being continuously victimized, that has a lot of, that puts a lot of strain on their self-esteem and on the way they see their self and their outlook on life. And so before they can even get to the point of wanting to have another job, there's a lot of counseling and different things that are mm-hmm. going to go into just helping them get over what they've gone through.
Sure. Well, I think it's interesting to see, of course, you know, when people say trafficking or prostitution, it's not something that people typically think of as happening in their own backyard or at the hotel down the street, because you see it typically, you know, happening on CNN in another country. But I do understand that you spent some time in Myanmar working there with some victims of
yes.
sexual violence. Did that open up any understanding of the situation in a different perspective? Like, what's going on here, what you saw there?
I don't really know how much it changed my perspective, but I think for some people it would change their perspective. I've been so ingrained in learning about this problem as a local and global problem for so long, but it is interesting just to see the differences, and I think that that is a lot of why it goes unnoticed here, because people do see it as this big global issue, and it happens differently here than I think it does in, like I said, mm-hmm. how people see it as these big, like, organized crime type things. I think that people think that in other countries it happens that way, but I don't think that that's always necessarily true. I think that it can be similar in both. Here in
Sergeant Mutz, Evansville Police, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that. So it's happening on a small scale, not necessarily organized. Is that, I would imagine, part of the internet? People can market themselves, I suppose.
Sure. And, you know, from speaking with some of the people that we run across, you know, that are engaging in prostitution, you know, one of the things they have to decide is, do they want, you know, the protection of, you know, their pimp is their protection. So, you know, some go that route for the protection provided, but with that protection comes a loss of control. I think there's both,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think it's difficult to put a one or the other on it without getting into each individual case, because it's so hard to tell, you know, if it's when you're looking at a massage parlor. You know, the answer is you get a ticket and you leave town and go someplace else, because there's always, you know, another place to go work. They'll go to Indianapolis, they'll go to Cincinnati, they'll go to Louisville, they'll go to St. Louis. They'll just catch the bus and go to make the next stop. So the problem is revolving doors, and identifying those people is very difficult because of, you know, we're a free society. You can move anywhere you want and do pretty much anything you want. Some of the indicators that are significant for human trafficking are, you know, evidence that people are being held against their will. You know, typically doors are on the inside to keep people out, not on the outside to keep people in. That's a big one. You know, that people don't have access to that somebody is holding identification, you know, especially passports and identification of somebody else, that they're, you know, that mm-hmm. is also limiting their ability to go places and do things, because of everything you need to do, you need an ID card. You know, almost everything in life except voting, you have to have an ID card. So the restriction of movement is probably one of the biggest indicators that probably separates prostitution from mm-hmm. you know, more organized human trafficking.
Anything, you know, regular citizens, maybe somebody listening, they could kind of keep an eye out for, even something that hotel operators should be looking out for?
Well, I think, you know, you know, if you have people that don't really speak the language well, they're new to the country, new to the area, you know, really, it would be hard as a hotel manager that's, you know, hey, I know enough English that I can go rent a room and I can take it, you know, then I go to the room and then the rest you don't see,
mm-hmm.
Would be difficult. But, you know, a person that has limited ability to speak English is at greater risk. Because of the communication barrier, to say that, hey, I have a problem, would be another significant risk factor. Again, the mobility that, you know, the lack of ID cards, you know, the doors that are keeping people in instead of keeping people out, those are primarily the mm-hmm. biggest red flags that we come across.
Whitney, anything else you would add to that?
I think age is a big factor, because especially when you're considering not just foreign-born victims, but victims that are citizens, because a Justice Department a few years ago found that 83% of sex trafficking victims are actually United States citizens. So 83% of victims that were found were victims of the United States. And a lot of those victims, like he mentioned earlier, are going to be those young girls, runaways, that are vulnerable and mm-hmm. looking for protection are going to be those ones that end up in sex trafficking. So just, you know, if a young girl is coming to the hotel, things like that, or being, you know, some other red flags would just be that they're staying, there's people going in and out of the rooms, but that the woman isn't leaving. I think more generally, some of the red flags are,
No, it's okay. But I actually have a follow-up to that.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure you get asked this question often, is, you know, if someone is in an oppressive prostitution situation, why don't these women leave? I'm sure that's a question people often think mm-hmm. about, but there's a lot of psychological manipulation involved.
Yeah.
What can you explain that for us?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of links between that and, you know, why women stay in domestic violence situations. They have some level of connection to this person, especially with domestic minor sex trafficking. Sometimes that person is the only person that's ever shown that they care for them, and so they don't even necessarily see themselves as a victim, because one thing that's always been interesting to me, one training that I went to, Tracy McDaniel, who works with victims in Indianapolis, she said that this is not their worst day, because a lot of people that end up being sex trafficked have been continuously victimized throughout their life. So they're living in poverty. They've probably been sexually abused as a child. They may have run away from home or been in and out of foster homes growing up. And so they've had so much trauma throughout their life that when this guy comes into their life and says, hey, I'll take care of you, buys them things, gives them a place to stay, and then over time, after he's built that relationship, he says, okay, well, if you're going to stay here, you have to work for it. And he starts, you know, sends her to work at a club, or sends her to, you know, engage in prostitution. And by that point, there is kind of this trauma bonding where they have a bond with this person where it's hard for them to leave. But then also as they get older, with prostitution being illegal, or if they are a foreign-born victim, they get scared to go to law enforcement or to get help, because they know that on some level they've done things that are illegal as well. So I think that is another way that keeps them definitely trapped, beyond just, you know, locks on the outside of the door and
mm-hmm.
Physical abuse, like fear of being physically hurt. There are those, like you mentioned, psychological things that are keeping them trapped as well, because they don't want to they feel like they don't have any other options.
That's interesting. Is there something that should, I don't know, some kind of structure that needs to be there, some resource that's missing that would help with that situation?
I think if we're talking specifically about domestic minor sex trafficking, I think just support throughout their life when they're growing up. They need to have, you know, adults in their life that care about them. They need proper services if they are victimized. And those are the kinds of things that not all kids are getting when those kinds of things happen to them, because sadly there's so much of it going on and things aren't getting properly treated when the situation happens. And so when they've continued to be victimized throughout their life and no one's catching that, then that's how it ends up growing. And one of the things that IPATH is working on is that they're training people that work with youth to identify trafficking and to work with teens that are at risk. There's a organization that does a training that's called My Life, My Choice, and it's specifically for working with females who are vulnerable or at risk or have been trafficked, and mm-hmm. it's just about teaching them self-esteem and how to protect themselves from that. And so these are girls that have already had those kinds of experiences throughout life that make them vulnerable to the situation, but just education in general about mm-hmm. human trafficking and healthy relationships and domestic violence and all these different things that are kind of a growing thing in the realm of domestic violence, sexual assault, and trafficking is just prevention for, you know, all levels of the community. Mm-hmm.
Well, we are going to take a quick break here on The Trend. Today's topic, human trafficking and prostitution, an international, even local issue. With me, I've got Sergeant Gregory Motes from the Evansville Police and Whitney Weir from Albion Fellows Bacon Center. You can call us with your questions, 812-426-7400, or send us a tweet at The Trend Talks. Good afternoon. You're listening to The Trend on WNIN. I'm Cass Harrington. Joining me in the studio, Whitney Weir from Albion Fellows Bacon Center and Sergeant Gregory Motes from the Evansville Police Department. And we are taking your calls and your tweets. So why don't you bring us your question? Join the conversation on the air, 812-426-7400. Or on Twitter at The Trend Talks. And I wanted to bring in an opposing kind of perspective on this conversation. I don't know if it's opposition, but just a different voice coming from some economists who argue that the prohibition of sex trade has been a failure. I have an article from The Economist that says legalizing prostitution would reduce violence against those selling sex, making it a more regulated market, which is kind of similar to arguments in favor of legalizing pot or abortion, that it would be more regulated, there would be, you know, workers' rights. Have you given this argument any consideration or thought, or is it even being talked about?
Well, if you look at places where prostitution is legalized, there are typically very strict regulations as far as public health concerns on the workers themselves, and there are places and there's do's and don'ts that typically the individual market is not, you know, there are brothels and places that you go to that are regulated by the government to allow that. So, you know, there are some protections involved there. And again, that's a community, you know, morality decision, you know, whether that as to how that problem is dealt with. You know, that's how our system of government works. And it's, mm-hmm. you know, the involvement of the people involved that determine the legality of prostitution, marijuana, and, you know, everything that we do that governs our lives daily. So really that doesn't change, you know, it's.
But do you think it would become, I guess, less, for lack of a better word, less of a seedy operation, that, you know, more people would be safer, there would be less incidents of trafficking and abuse?
If you look at, let's take marijuana, for example. If you look at the legalization issues, pros and cons, you know, you take a $50 billion a year industry that, you know, that we spend significant resources to combat, and you turn it into a profit, more profitable and regulated. You know, there are some consumer safeties, and you also remove a significant income source for your global narcotics trafficking networks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a balance to that. And again, it's going to come down to the community decision upon what you choose for your community.
Whitney?
I think that demand is what drives sex trafficking. So I think that if it's legalized on both sides, that's not going to necessarily curb the problem. I think sometimes it will help maybe with less instances of violence towards prostitutes, but I don't think that it would stop human trafficking, because that it could create possibly more demand, because like what we were talking about with the sting and these drones being arrested, if they don't have consequences for that, then they'll continue to do it. So I think that increasing demand is going to increase sex trafficking. I think that people think that legalizing it is a good idea because in places like Sweden, they've changed the laws and trafficking has dropped a lot. But in Sweden, it is legal to sell sex, but it's not legal to buy it. And so when there are those two things together, I think are what has made it safer there and has decreased trafficking there. But if it's legal on both sides, I don't necessarily know that there would be a large mm-hmm. decrease in trafficking, because, you know, there are other crimes that are illegal and are regulated by the government, but that doesn't mean that people always obey that. And so I don't think that necessarily if there were regulations for brothels and things like that, I personally don't think that there would necessarily be a decrease in trafficking.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly, I think, a perspective worth discussing, because, you know, another problem is, like we've been discussing, the stigma that, you know, prostitutes are, you know, victimized or helpless, or, I mean, some are in the business because, let's face it, it's money, it's a job. But in Indiana, is it mostly the case that it's associated with abuse or a trafficking situation? Is there a way to some data to support that?
You know, again, it's very difficult to determine a forced prostitution from a pseudo consensual. And typically I would say the most likely that I've seen, or the most indicative, is the dependency, the previous physical abuse, domestic abuse, those kind of issues are probably what you're going to see most in a local case.
All right. Well, anything else that our listeners should know? I know, Whitney, there's an event coming up in April. Did you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So at Albion, we are really trying to educate our community more on human trafficking, because the fight against human trafficking is a growing movement in our country. I was speaking with our executive director the other day, Candace Perry, and we were talking about this growing movement, and she said something that really stuck out to me, that movements are made of moments, and that our community has a moment right now to begin to educate ourselves on and take notice of this crime. And so we have every year we do an annual training on domestic violence and sexual assault. And this spring, our training's coming up on April 30th and May 1st. And we've chosen the topic of human trafficking this year. And so that training will be at Ivy Tech, and it's open to the community. It's actually 2 one-day trainings. We're offering the same training both days, but it's human trafficking myths, facts, and community response. And most years, that's generally attended. Our training's generally attended by social service providers, law enforcement. We have EPD and the sheriff's office are usually represented. But just as this is a growing movement, we are really wanting to open it up to the whole community. Anyone that's interested in learning more about human trafficking, we will be having representatives from IPATH, from the Attorney General's office, and from Restored, which is a nonprofit working with victims in that area, and the state police.
So real quick, though, so it sounds like a training with education aspect to it. So what is the biggest thing or kind of misunderstanding that people have to learn, or the tool in their toolkit for helping with this problem?
I think the biggest thing is that people, and we've talked about this throughout the show today, people see it as a global problem, and people don't recognize that it is a local problem. They think, no one thinks that it's okay, but people don't recognize and accept that it is happening in our country and in our state and in our community. And so I think that's the most important thing for people to recognize, that it is worth being educated on beyond what you see on the news, because it's possible that any of us could be the one to recognize something.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, we'll have more information about that event on the website. Oh, real quick, what is the date of that event?
April 30th and May 1st.
Okay, we'll have that information on the website along with your contact information. And Sergeant Motes, any useful information for listeners who might want to get involved, or what they could do?
Well, as always with anything, if you suspect that you know a person, or especially a child who may be involved in an abuse or a sex trafficking, if you have that, if that thought goes through your mind, say something. If you're wrong, no harm done. We go out and we investigate and say, that's not the case. It's whatever it is. But at the end of the day, if you say something, it gets the ball rolling and we find out whether it is or it isn't, one way or the other.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to switch gears on the trend and get a little music in here before the weekend, lighten it up a bit. This year, WNIN produced its first bilingual radio program, Nuestras Americas, and during the first episode, we previewed the music of Making Movies. It's a multicultural rock band whose members are from Panama, Mexico, and the United States. They're based in the Midwest, and their latest album, A La Deriva, tells the story of immigrants' struggles with identity and family in the U.S. I sat down with the Panamanian-American bandmates and brothers Enrique and Diego Chi to learn how they're weaving their cross-cultural heritage into their music.
My name is Enrique Chi. I am the lead singer and guitarist for Making Movies.
And my name is Diego Chi, and I play bass in Making Movies. Our parents, Enrique and I are brothers, they moved to Kansas City. My dad wanted to study, and he ended up doing his courses. They thought it would just be temporary and they'd go back, but they ended up staying 20-some-odd years. And so that's how we ended up in Kansas City, of all places in the world. For us, what felt natural to combine were what we grew up with. Our mother was a big dancer, and she loved anything that had a rhythm and that she could move her feet to.
The pendulum swings a crazy thing. It'll kick you down, can make you sing. No matter how my ears ring, I need them more. Just can't get enough.
We got a lot of the Latin influences from listening to those dance songs, and then our father was a rocker, so he loved everything, from the 60s onward, as far as rock music is concerned. And so for us, it felt natural to blend those two ideas, no different than it felt natural to switch between English and Spanish at home. And so that's kind of how that blend came together for us.
I think that part of
what flavors our music and part of our story is this combination of that once you're an immigrant somewhere, and especially we're from Panama, there's not a lot of Panamanian people in Kansas City, but you do attach yourself to other immigrants. So we get this Venezuelan family that's a dear family friend, and this Colombian family, and these Mexican families, and then all of a sudden there's a camaraderie in being immigrants to a city, and so our lives had all these different influences. My mom learned how to make Mexican food in the United States, and all these other dishes, and I learned how to eat pupusas from Honduras, and all that stuff. Stuff that, like, if I would have just been in Panama, I think I wouldn't have been exposed to. And so our music is kind of all mixed up. It's like what happens when you move to a city and you become a part of that culture, and it becomes a part of you. But you, if you don't lose the other parts of your culture, you end up kind of this person that can navigate these different worlds. And I feel like our music does that. I said stop right where you are. Now I can see you falling through. I said stop right where you are.
Hey! It seems like the theme of, like, Latin Americanismo is getting louder. And I wonder if that's a side effect of, you know, immigrant communities coming together, like you said, Colombians, Venezuelans, all hanging out as a means of having a louder collective voice. And your music does that beautifully. Just a tapestry of, you've got the Caribeño music, you've got a little bit of Andean folklore, and it kind of, I think, illustrates what's happening in America with immigrant communities.
I don't think we set out to do that, yeah. But I do think that is what happened, and I agree, the voice is getting louder. Yo fui buscando mi luz y mi bandera.
Como marinero busca la... Right now, we're noticing, as we travel around the United States, that it seems like there is this bubbling shift in the culture that people, and we're running into actually a lot of pushback, and I think it comes from perhaps this older mentality, these older expectations from what music that is in Spanish can be. As we're traveling, we're finding that there are immigrant communities that are hungry for something much richer, much deeper than what is currently available in bilingual and in Spanish music as well. I mean, music that's in Spanish. So that's kind of what we're aiming for, to not let ourselves follow any lower expectation, but to go as deep and as rich into the cultures that we came from and the other immigrant communities that we've become a part of by living here in the United States as immigrants.
And from touring and interacting with your audience, which I imagine must be very, very energizing, because you're reaching a diverse population, black, white, Hispanic, bilingual, or gringo who doesn't know anything but Burrito.
That was me talking with Diego and Enrique Chi of the bilingual rock band Making Movies. You can listen to the full interview online, WNIN.org. That wraps up The Trend this afternoon. The program is a production of WNIN-FM Evansville. Paola Marisan produced this program. Brianna Williams engineered the show. Jeffrey Osman wrote the theme music. And I'm your host, Cass Harrington. Stay with us next week as we talk about women in the workplace. That should be interesting. This is WNIN-FM Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro. We'll